This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. We are at episode 13, talking about common factors today. But before we get there, I wanted to just wish everybody happy holidays. This is the last show of the year. We're coming right into the Christmas and New Year's holiday, and I just wanted to thank everybody for listening. Those of you who have been with us from the beginning, as well as those that are new to the show, welcome. Judging by my stats counter, it's been growing, which is exciting, and it's been growing all over the world. So we have listeners as far away as India and Vietnam, Canada down to Brazil, and of course Africa up to Europe. So it's just been very exciting to watch this happen. We appreciate your support, and we appreciate you listening in. So happy holidays, everybody. If you're looking for a last-minute gift, just hit me up. I have new Radical Therapist stickers and would be happy to send them to you. Just shoot me an email, theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. I will send you some stickers and get those to you right away. And if I would love a picture back of you with the sticker, the sticker is put somewhere interesting, bar bathrooms, I don't care. Just send me back a picture. That would be great. And also, if you could, as always, go on to iTunes and rate and review the show, that is very much appreciated, and it helps us just get the word out. So please do that. This is our, like I said, our last show of the year. I think it's one of our best shows. I'm talking with Dr. Davis, Sean Davis, around common factors, are models important, what happens when people get narrow and dogmatic about their models, therapeutic alliance, how do you teach that? It was just a very wide-ranging conversation. I think you're going to really enjoy it, as I did. So please stay tuned for that. But before we get there, let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Davis. Dr. Sean Davis is an associate professor at the Couple and Family Therapy Program at Alliant International University's campus in Sacramento, California. And he is an approved supervisor and clinical member of the AAMFT. Dr. Davis also serves on the editorial board of the Journal of Marital and Family Therapy. His research, clinical, and teaching interests focus on common factors in bridging the scientist-practitioner gap in marriage and family therapy. His dissertation on common factors won the 2005 AAMFT Graduate Student Research Award and the 2006 AAMFT Dissertation Award. Dr. Davis has published several journal articles and books, including, most recently, What Makes Couples Therapy Work, and the Family Therapy Treatment Planner, second edition. And he maintains a private practice in Sacramento. And I think this last year, I know that he was involved in an article that won best article from JMFT this year. So that's kind of exciting for Dr. Davis as well. So without further ado, let's learn about common factors in couple and family therapy and what really works in therapy with Dr. Sean Davis. All right. Well, welcome to the show, Dr. Davis.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking the time. And I have planned for us kind of a wide-ranging conversation all around the paradigm, or I'm not going to call it a model, but the paradigm of common factors. Yeah. And but I guess I wanted to start sharing a little bit about my own experience, because I really didn't get exposed to common factors in my master's program until the very tail end. And I imagine that's probably common. Mm-hmm. But I think I went to a Scott Miller workshop somewhere towards the tail end of and that's where I first got exposed to it. And it wasn't until my doctoral program where I began to bump into common factors, and it really created a lot of curiosity in me. And I kind of identify with a particular model, narrative therapy, but I also noticed, and some people might disagree with me on some of this, but that there was a lot of congruency, or narrative therapy, if looking at common factors through narrative therapy, I thought it was a pretty good delivery system for common factors.
Right.
So I didn't feel any incongruence in it, and I wanted to kind of learn more about it. And I really like this kind of focus on the therapeutic relationship and how do we do that? Because I don't think it gets trained really well, you know, in programs. And I know that's kind of your place. You do a lot of training and supervision in that arena, and we'll get there. But before we start, I think we maybe it would be helpful for our listeners and even for me if you could maybe tell us maybe a history of common, even what are common factors, and maybe even a history of common factors and how they came to be. And I like this idea in your book. Let me give you the title, the title, Common Factors in Couple and Family Therapy, The Overlooked Foundation of for Effective Practice. But I like how it's positioned, common factors are positioned now as kind of the counterculture to the really model-based, in our field, it's so model-specific and even personality-specific in some cases. But I think I like how it's positioned as counterculture. But maybe you could start by telling us a little bit about the history of common factors, what they are, and how you came to be really interested in them.
Okay. Yeah, sure. And glad to. Common factors started mostly in clinical psychology. In fact, clinical psychology became interested in it around the turn of last century, actually, the early 1900s. They started looking into, maybe there's more similar to what we're doing than different, before our field even existed, our field being MFT. And it kind of went from there. It really picked up momentum in the 80s, actually, in clinical psychology. Simon has a book that he put out about common factors, sort of what are the commonalities. Like he looked across healing practices in general, not just therapy, and came up with some of the things that he thought. And then it went from there. Mike Lambert at BYU in the early 90s published a paper that became really famous where he proposed that different amounts of, you know, what accounted for change. And he had, I believe it was like 40% was due to, I don't have the statistics off the top of my head. You don't hear them cited quite as much anymore, but like 40% of the change was due to stuff outside of therapy, you know, and then another big chunk was due to the therapist or to the client's attributes rather thing, and then a piece of it was due to their, motivation, stuff like that, a piece due to whether they thought they were going to improve. Yeah, that, and then just
expectancy and hope.
Expectancy, yeah, exactly, and the hope. And then just a little bit due to the interventions themselves. So that was in clinical psychology, but it was always kind of a counterculture movement, like you were saying there as well. It became the first MFT article published on common factors was in the late 90s. I believe it was 99 with Doug Sprinkle, Blow, and Dickey in the first edition of The Heart and Soul of Change. And then it just sort of trickled down from there. It's becoming a lot more popular. The next article, I think, after that was several years later, where Doug Sprinkle and Adrian Blow had a sort of a dialogue back and forth in JMFT, a debate with some other more model-specific scholars. Then our book came out, but it's still a fairly small movement in MFT, to be honest. I'm glad that I see it picking up more. I'm on the review board for JMFT, and I review several articles on common factors every year. So it's fun to see it gaining momentum.
So you're seeing more and more interest, both in the literature and how about in the programs, teaching programs?
Yeah, and teaching programs as well. Whenever I do a presentation, say at the AAMFT conference or something on education, they're always very well attended with my colleagues and I. So it is gaining momentum. It's gaining momentum in teaching as well. I think because it resonates with people, most people, in my experience, learn a lot of models in their training. Then they get to be good at one or two of them, and then they leave, and then they go out. And they find themselves sort of picking and choosing from a lot of different techniques and become kind of a grab bag or hodgepodge of what of a lot of different techniques. So, but they don't really know what to call it, or they feel like I'm cheating. You know, my professors told me I'm not supposed to be eclectic, that that's a cop out, but yeah. I feel, you know, yeah. but I am. Yeah. And so it, I think it, when they hear of common factors, it resonates. It gives them a language for what they're doing anyway.
Yeah. And how do you attend to this? I think eclecticism has turned into kind of a bad word in some
right.
ways. And I know in the book, and I like how you positioned it, or you call it informed eclecticism, mm-hmm. Or this integrative approach. And do you find resistance to that, or like a...
I do, but I think the resistance is primarily because it's not, we just haven't found the right language to talk about what people are actually are doing.
Okay.
Like if you look at what, you go out and look at good clinicians, okay, what is your average really good solid clinician doing? A lot of them, it is sort of a hodgepodge. Like if you coded their sessions, for example, you'd see elements of a lot of different theories. And I think more so than a specific model is what these guys are good at and gals are good at is figuring out what I call principles of change. They're just really good at understanding what clients need at a particular time. And then they have a good enough understanding of different models to be able to sort of pull from different ones to tailor the treatment to what resonates with the client.
So how do you, I know there's some that would say you should go deep at least in one model. Mm-hmm. So you do have a language for mm-hmm. that kind of, I don't know if comparison is the right word, but you know, maybe even common factors. So you can notice sure. the common factors across models. Mm-hmm. What do you mm-hmm. think about that idea of rather than maybe a couple or, but going deep with really one model?
Yeah, yeah, no. And, you know, a lot of times that is put up as sort of the dichotomy to common factors, but I don't think it is. I actually am one that says you should go deep with different models. I just think you shouldn't stop at one. I think, yeah, learn one really in depth, take a couple of years, do the trainings, get the supervision, read the books, really immerse yourself in that, and then move on to the next one. You know, you've got your whole career to do this. And so the more, if you look actually at current model developers, say like Sue Johnson, I'm a fan of IFS, like Dick Schwartz.
Right.
A lot of these models are, they're integrations of several different models that the developers knew quite well. You know?
Right. And you say something in the book, and it's almost a critique that sometimes overt or covertly, they don't recognize or they don't make visible that they did borrow from several other ideas or...
I think that, yeah, that there's a tendency to do that. Or they do, but then sometimes will sort of poo-poo the original theories that they got it from. And I wouldn't say that necessarily about Sue Johnson or Dick Schwartz as individuals, but I think there's the tendency to do that in the field, to create something new and then denigrate the ideas that you got your ideas from.
Right. And while we're on that, you and I, prior to getting on the mics, had a brief conversation about this idea of the selling of models and maybe the cult of personality and model development. And you had a take that you think it's kind of harmful to our field. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Well, my own experience as a trainee a long time ago, and then the experience of my students now is really similar. You'll go to a training, say like a 4-day externship or something, and you come back from it. And I, as a student, I would come back from it. I would go into it feeling pretty good, like, okay, I'm starting to get a handle on this. And then come back from it feeling like, man, I don't know anything. Or like there's no way I can be as good as that person was, that guru. And because the message at the trainings is pretty clear, there's a lot of denigrating of other approaches. There's a lot of, hey, well, EFT is so much better than these other things because we address A, B, C, D, and here's why that's important. Or, you know, I pick EFT just because that's the popular one now, but you hear that with any of them, I think.
You can call out narrative. I won't take it
personally. Narrative, sure. Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We could get a little that way too, I think.
Everyone can, yeah. And I tell my students, I'm like, if you... the more devoted and sort of dogmatic about a model as person gets, the more that person embodies what that model describes as dysfunction. So,
in other words, my gosh, that's so accurate.
Like, for example, like, why are you so insecurely attached to EFT? You know, like, let it get kicked around a bit. Who cared? You know, if you were secure in it, you wouldn't mind people critiquing it.
Yeah, right.
Or you know, like, with narrative, why are you so locked in on this one reality? You know?
Right. Exactly.
Or like, yeah. Bowen, it's like, yeah, it's being so undifferentiated, yeah, about, you know, other ideas. Yeah. So
that's so funny.
But it happens, right? And then, yeah, students come back and they're discouraged. They're like, man, this, I was feeling pretty good about myself, but now there's no way I can be like that. And so I tell them, you're right, you can't be like that. But look, don't think, I mean, couples, individuals, people have been healing and getting better for a long time, long before this approach came around. Mm. So it has helpful things, learn them, but don't abandon what you already know and are already good at.
Yeah, and you talk about, and I'm not gonna go there yet, but this idea of professional modesty, but we'll get there. But before we do, I really want to kind of maybe lay out common factors. What are common, sure, factors across models?
Yeah. Well, they're generally divided into sort of two camps. You have broad and narrow, but the general idea of common factors is that the things that are responsible for change are not unique to any one particular theoretical model. You know, we used to think of our theoretical models were like the equivalent of medicine or a pill in medicine.
Right.
You give it to people and they get better. That's not the case very much. And so common factors are what are the things that help people get better. So you look at the alliance, the nature of the therapeutic alliance, which we can talk more about. The a client's individual traits, you know, of course, how hard a person works at something has a lot to do with whether they're going to get it or not. And that's, the therapist only has so much control over that. The therapist traits, you know, how in tune to your clients are you? How capable are you of kind of adapting to what your clients need? Getting feedback about the process and tailoring it as accordingly. Those are all common types of common factors. Expectancy, hope, you know, if people come in expecting to get better. Mm. Those types of things that have nothing to do with the theory.
Right. So why do you think relational therapists, and even though sort of lump in the postmoderns, are kind of resistant to or not paying attention to common factors or some of these ideas? What do you think people are afraid of, I guess?
Right. Well, it's a step into ambiguity. You know, it's there is safety and there's comfort in a model and in saying here's what it is. But the reality is models have only taken us so far. You know, our outcomes haven't, as a field, they're good, but they haven't improved at all in the last 30 or 40 years. Mm. So The resistance, I think, is in some ways it's a huge paradigm shift. Like, okay, so if we, what do we do with our models then? We've built our career on these. Our training programs center on this.
Yes.
Our books, you know, half the books on my shelf are about theory models. Like, if it's not that, then what? It's almost like, are we reinventing a new field? We're not, of course. We're just expanding what we have. But it's a big question.
Yeah, and I think that ambiguity, right? It really really points to that ambiguity and our uneasiness with that.
Sure.
And you alluded to the fact that we're in a field that is dominated by the model paradigm, right? And mm-hmm. evidence supported, I think, treatments is what you call them, mm-hmm. evidence based practice.
Right.
And you talk in the book. I guess there's a couple questions here. It's about, you know, how realistic is it to move away from that so dominant, right? And then
right.
And you are, and I appreciate this about it, you're kind of critical about this evidence-supported treatment that you talk mm-hmm. in the book, that when models that promote evidence-based, like EFT, are compared against bona fide treatments, there really is no difference. But when they're compared mm-hmm. against, like, no treatment, there's difference. But and then you're making the case for common factors. But
yeah.
But you are critical of this movement towards evidence-based practice, right?
Yeah, because I think it's. I mean, it serves a purpose. It serves, but it doesn't serve the purpose we think it does. The purpose it serves, I think, is legitimizing the profession in the eyes of third parties, you know, the public, the scientific community, etc. But it's based on a faulty premise, or at least an incomplete premise, that being that the theory is the main contributor of change, which it simply isn't. You actually find a lot more variability in individual therapists. You know, another thing I tell my students is the theory, there is really no such thing as a theory. Like, theories don't exist. What exists, as far as therapy is concerned, is a therapist manifesting a theory. Hmm. It's a therapist taking the ideas of a theory and then he or she bringing those ideas to life. And some therapists do that better than others, frankly, which is just sort of common sense, but it also bears out in the research as well.
Right.
And
now your thoughts about how, is there a way to begin to move away from that model dominant focus in our field and in our practice, in our agencies and our wherever?
Yeah, I think so. I think as common factors become more important or more fleshed out, it will become an easier thing to move away from. The trick is, I think a lot of clinicians already have moved away from it. They just we don't have a formal way of talking about what they are doing.
Right.
Sort of circling back to what we're talking about earlier.
So would you say that's your kind of program right now, is to kind of create a language to begin to talk about these ways?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's kind of where I'm going. What I'm really interested in these days is this idea of principles of change, you know? So what are the kind of general principles that unite? So say like Bowen is looking at it from one angle, narrative's looking at it from another angle, EFT from a third angle. My belief is that there are principles that unite what they are all paying attention to. For, you know, narrative may call it sort of expanding. Yeah, I don't know, off the top of my head, it was like expanding thickening the narrative.
Or the alternative
narrative. The alternative narrative, yeah, exactly. But they're all basically just trying to get this person to sort of slow down, consider a way of looking at the situation other than what they currently are doing, you know, becoming more empathetic to what's happening, that type of thing. Yeah. And in doing so, They're all doing the same thing though, just with different words. And so, what's the principle that unites the three of them? I think a lot of therapists do that anyway. They have kind of an intuitive understanding of that. The longer they work, the researchers and the writers haven't caught up with them yet.
So how do you, like, coming from maybe the post-structuralist or postmodern perspective, mm-hmm. then in that principle of change, how do you account for, like, larger, maybe social discourse or larger context?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And I think you call it like human, like, you know, you do attend to social justice or human diversity issues. Can you say more about that?
Sure. No, those are a hugely an inescapably important part of what goes on. You know, the people walking into your office bring with them their navigation of so many different cultural layers, social layers that they are going through. And you have to pay attention to that. You have to be tuned into those things. Mm. Which again, I think a good therapist understands that and is tuned into that. Maybe if they don't know every aspect of their client's culture, they at least know enough. They know how to find out.
Okay. You talked about the principles of change. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how Common Factors conceptualizes difficulties, A, and then maybe conceptualizes change.
Sure. Well, yeah, that's a good question. And honestly, that's where the research is right now, is figuring out, because the dilemma is, there's the risk of, the more you answer that question, the more you're just sort of creating another model.
Right, right.
So the question really is, how do all of these other theories conceptualize difficulties? What are the commonalities in the way they are conceptualizing difficulties? Is one way of answering that question. And that's the common factor. One example from a study I did several years ago, one commonality we found across different theories was when a couple comes in, we did it on couples therapy. When they come in, regardless of the theory, the therapist is helping the couple slow down their process, A, B, be able to sort of reflect on their own role in contributing to that process, and then C, encouraging that the client takes responsibility for changing their own role in the process. So those three things were happening: slowing down, reflecting on your own role, and then taking responsibility for changing that role. Every one of the different theorists were doing those things. It's just they use different language, they use different techniques, they focused on different aspects, like a more cognitive focus versus a more emotional focus.
Or I was thinking narrative might look at it from a gendered power perspective, and EFT mm-hmm. from a making patterns visible perspective.
Exactly.
But just kind of maybe doing the same things in some ways, but through different language.
Different language, yeah. But you're all focused on the same thing. You're all focused on, okay, let's help this couple slow down, take a deep breath, look at what's going on, see how they might be contributing to the problem, and then sort of, there's a lot of nuance to that too, doing it in a way where they are allowed to not be, the bad guy, the villain, where you see sort of the good intent. You frame it as this is your good intent. You're trying your very best to make it through a difficult situation, helping their partner see that, and then make it easier to respond to them as a result. But different theories, all of the theories we looked at were doing that, just in different ways.
Okay. Now, you mentioned you're not looking to create a new model, but you describe it in the book as maybe looking at it like a meta model.
Right.
That that, and you're also, and I guess I should say, you're not anti-model either.
No, not at all. I love theories. In fact, I became interested in common factors out of the love of theory.
Do you align? Can I just ask you to align with a particular model? Or?
I get asked that a lot. Yeah, and it changes. Yes, there are some that I really resonate with. Oddly enough, no one ever talks about this theory anymore, but I really like object relations. I get really fascinated by that and have found that my way of doing it, I've found a lot of success with it. I think Bowen's ideas are really interesting, some of them. I like EFT. I really do like all theories, though, and I know it sounds like a cop-out, but I'm sort of a theory junkie. Yeah. But if you watched me work, you'd see a lot of EFT, you'd see a lot of sort of, I present like more of a psychodynamic
Interesting.
Approach.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So models do matter, and I think you characterized them as I'm going to use the word. I don't know if you use this word, but I'm going to use it like a delivery system.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Of common factors.
We say you can't do therapy without a model. Like you can't. You are going to walk into a session with assumptions about how things work, about how this is going to go, with a way of making sense of things, which we argue is a model. So, yeah, of course they work. It's just they aren't as central as we have talked about them.
Okay, so in the meta model approach, you're more interested in kind of regardless of model, but I still think, from my opinion alert,
yeah,
still think some models deliver common factors better than others.
I would agree.
Okay,
yeah.
But you're interested in, because there's a wide variety of therapists, wide variety of models, but maybe superimposing, beginning to get people to look at these common factors and then kind of superimposing them in whatever work they're kind of doing.
Yes, exactly. And maybe if I could put a little...
Sure.
Twist or offer a little twist to one thing you said is in saying some do it better than others. What I would say there from a common factors perspective is that some therapists do it better than others.
Okay.
Models themselves don't necessarily have attributes as much as therapists that do the models have attributes. So I've seen some beautifully compassionate structural therapists, for example, which is historically thought of as a little more like controlling and manipulative or strategic,
right,
you know,
right.
Even take it up from there. And I've seen some horribly manipulative, postmodern therapists.
Sure.
And so it's the therapist that matters more than the model. A lot of times we talk about models as we sort of demonize the model itself, which I think is unfair.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Fair. That's
which
is going to lead us
a nuance.
Yeah, and it's going to lead us into what I really think is fascinating. Before I get there, though, teaching and training and supervision. But can you speak to some of maybe the common critiques of common factors? What are you bumping into with your colleagues, et cetera?
Yeah, one of the main critiques is that it's just too broad to be useful. And to be fair, I think there's some merit to that in the current state of the common factors literature. You know, as it exists, it is primarily just like here are some lists of common factors. We know that the alliance is important, for example. But then a theory-specific person will come along and say, well, yeah, we believe that too. That doesn't give anything. That doesn't contribute much. But it can. It's just a state of the field. You can look at, okay, in what way is the alliance important? How is it, what comprises the alliance, those types of things? So as the movement gets more momentum and starts to get more research, I think that concern will become a lot less relevant.
Okay. Yeah, because in the book you say, you know, if all therapy requires is a good relationship or offering a credible ritual to address problems, you know, why would somebody need therapy when they can go to their pastor or get a coffee with a friend kind of thing?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
There is more to that than...
Yes.
Yeah, right.
And another critique is that we just haven't... there could be differences among theories, we just haven't discovered them yet, and there's could be, you know, I'm open to that, and there are instances where certain approaches have been shown to be much more effective than others, with enough replication to that to be pretty confident.
Okay, so let's move to training and teaching.
Sure.
Because this is kind of, you know, revolutionary if you're countercultural, if you're going to move away from the model paradigm, right?
Sure.
But some of the ideas, so we'll go, you do have components that we'll run through, but before that, you said something, or you in the book, you talk about, you know, the idea that students should become passionate about theory rather than a theory. Can you say something about that, or even how you begin to instill that in students or get them excited about theory?
Sure. Yeah. Well, my philosophy is, as a professor, is I try to teach every single theory as if it's my favorite one. And nothing makes me happier. In fact, some of my second year master's students the other day, I heard them having a debate in the hall over which theory they thought I liked the most. Like, that was great. And they were each arguing like from very different theories. So that was success to me. So that's how I do it. But I do think you need to know a theory, and you need to know theories well. So to your question of, it's better to be passionate about theory than a theory. Yes, you do need a theory because, like most of the theories that we have, do call attention to very relevant issues in session, of course. And so the more of those you know, the more tools you'll have in your toolkit, the broader of a perspectives you'll be able to look at this through. Just don't limit yourself to one, because the whole hammer and nail thing, you know, if all you have is a hammer, everything has to become a nail. So another one of my favorite quotes is you can't, your client shouldn't have to add, figure out how to adapt to my therapist to their already lengthy list of challenges.
Gotcha. Like,
we should be adapting to them. Which different theories do?
Yeah, and another assumption is an appreciation for the human diversity issues, what we talked about, and also this idea that, you know, we are underestimating of client resourcefulness, right?
Yeah. Yes. So. Yeah, I can talk about that. But with the diversity issue, too, there's different, you know, and certainly other people other than me have argued for this, that certain theories match certain cultures better.
Yes, you know? Yeah, right.
Some cultures want you to be the therapist to be much more authoritative and much more, say, like strategic in terms of telling them, here's what I want you to do. Others prefer a much more collaborative approach. So I think part of being culturally sensitive is having enough theoretical depth to be able to mesh with those. So that's the cultural piece. What was
The underestimating client resourcefulness. And
yes,
you tell this and you point out, and I think this happens to all of us, but doesn't get talked about, this idea of how many times have our clients credited change to something we either never said or misunderstood. So
yes. If you think about, in my opinion, all of the emphasis on a theory, learn this model, do all of this stuff, you know, figure out all of, you develop all of these competencies, therapist. Implicit in that is the assumption that if you don't, there's no hope for the person that is sitting across the room from you.
Right, right.
Which is, in a way, a very kind of diminutive. It's not very hopeful, and I don't think it gives the client enough credit. Because we all have had this experience. I had not too long ago, actually, where a client comes in. We're finishing up. Things have gone well. And I have a habit of asking them what went well, what didn't, that type of thing. And they said, when you said this one thing, that really kind of like changed my view and unlocked this for me. And they misunderstood what I said. Like, it wasn't what I had actually said.
Right.
Some of my best work has been work I haven't actually done.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and that's true for a lot of us. And I think we sadly underestimate our clients' ability to pick something from what we are doing and make it work.
Make it work for them, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. Okay, so you list some component in the book, some components of common factors training programs, and maybe we can run through them and you can tell us a little bit about
sure.
them. But the first is an understanding of the principles of change. How do you go about this, or
sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and in fact, today I'm grading the paper where the students are doing this. So
yeah.
Good timing. I have students with that. I will have them reflect on their own beliefs about relationships. My opinion is that by the time you show up to learn how to be a therapist, you already have a lot of really deep beliefs and opinions about relationships in you from just going through life.
Sure, sure.
And those are going to be a lot of what drive your work. And a lot of those are probably already also found in the literature. So what I have students do is talk about those, do a lot of sort of soul searching on what some of those beliefs are. And then I have them go and find them in the literature, the sort of process like Gottman's literature type of stuff, looking at relationships, relational interaction. And then I have them find where those beliefs are manifest in the theories. So it's kind of a bottom-up approach, starting with what's already in them, rather than a top-down approach of saying, hey, here are the theories, learn them. It's, hey, what's in you, and go find those in the theories, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I have them do it through the lenses of at least two or three theories. And so they have to see how these principles that they believe exist in different theories.
And I'm thinking of another article I think you were an author on, and that's in regards to worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And even in my own research, I found, at least with beginning therapists, worldview is so critical to how they view these things anyway. And
mm-hmm.
so you're in some way beginning to make that visible and then having them go out and find it in
sure.
the theory. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. To try to make it more explicit.
Okay, so, and then the next is understanding, and this is an interesting one for me, an understanding of distressed and healthy couples. And you do count, there's a thousand ways you can characterize healthy couple, right?
I know, that's a little, yes, is it, I can understand from a postmodern perspective.
You knew that was coming for me.
It's
but.
Problematic, and fair enough.
But how do you conceptualize that? Or how do you begin to teach that?
Well, there's a fair amount of research on it out there already with, like I mentioned, Gottman's work a while ago, just a second
sure.
ago. He has all of his different, the process-based research out there looking at different, couples that tend to not work out. Here's what's going on. Those that do, here's what's going on. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that is just literature review type of stuff. But then others, I have them look at what do the theories say are when a couple or when someone comes in, and I would argue that even some of the postmodern approaches do have some assumptions about that.
Sure.
Like, like if someone is really locked in on one story that is not working for them, for example, or is not allowing them to see enough possibilities that they can navigate their situations effectively, then you help them, you know, expand their narrative, thicken their narrative a little bit, and look for other things. So,
well, I would even say those that are more critically theory-minded have particular lenses that they look at couples through, and that's through gender, power differentiation, you know, those kinds of things. So,
yeah, the different layers that the society puts on it. Yeah,
yep.
For sure. So,
are assumptions even in postmodern,
exactly. That some of the cultures. Yeah, let's look at some of these cultural assumptions about gender, about, you know, race, ethnicity, what have you, and question some of those. And there is pattern to that questioning. So,
yes,
which is fair enough. And so I have them look at those. I pick theories they resonate with. And what does your theory say is health? What do they say is struggle or dysfunction? I am moving away from those words. I think they're they don't sit as well with me these days.
And you move on to, and I think this is interesting, an understanding of non-clinical family-related research.
Sure, yeah, developmental stuff. You know, a lot of the stuff we get from the family science or psychology, you know, just developmental needs of people, that type of thing.
Sure. And an understanding.
We're to that really quickly. Most of our theories are change focused, and so we don't have quite as much. One of the weaknesses, I think, of our theory is we don't have quite as deep of a, or of our field, I mean, we don't have quite as deep of a well to draw from when it comes to just sort of like normative family development or something like that, which I know is also debatable.
Sure. One of your principles is this, and I want to comment on this a little bit, an understanding of broad common factors. And you do differentiate, because there is a narrow common factors approach, right?
Yeah.
Where they are really like models don't mean anything.
That's more the old kind of the radical, in the early days of common factors thinking in MFT, at least the language was a lot more radical and a lot more, models don't matter at all.
Right.
You don't hear people talking about that too much anymore.
Okay. So, but you have a very kind of broader, I think inclusive, it's roomy. I don't know.
Sure. Yeah. The difference, we call it a moderate common factors approach where we allow for models. It's, well, yes, models need to be there, but let's also look at these other factors, the relationship, the quality, the attributes of the therapist, the attributes of the client. It can be both and rather than either or.
And we just did a podcast on this recently with a couple of colleagues, and you also view that self of the therapist work is important.
Yes, hugely. I think of the aspects of therapy that a therapist has influence or control over, the self of the therapist, the therapist's own way of being is one of the very most important of those things, in my opinion.
Yeah, and we're going to get to how you talk about that in a sec. But finally, this is really interesting. I guess this resonates with me in some ways just because of some things I'm thinking about recently. But you kind of ended all with this, really asking for a climate of reflective theoretical inclusivity. And you point out that that us relational experts refusing to get along with each other because of models is kind of ironic in some ways.
Yeah, it's not very isomorphic to the whole, what we're all about, right?
Yeah, right. So can you talk about that? How do you create this kind of this inclusivity in what you do and how you are and in your work?
Sure. I think it comes down to realizing that there can be space at the table for pretty much any theory. You know, any theory has something to offer that others don't. Any theory, even if that is just simply, it will resonate more with some clients than another theory will. And so letting go of this sort of defensive clinging to our one approach, cling to it, that's fine, but just allow other people to cling to theirs as well. Which interestingly, that philosophy is sort of a bedrock of most theories, I think, you know, having someone become more compassionate, more accepting, more tolerant, but it doesn't, we don't put that into practice as much as we could, I think.
Yeah. And you were recently part of an article, I think it won an award, right? Like,
yeah, it did. Yeah. Thank you. We got the article of the year award from JMFT for that one.
Yeah. Awesome. So the title of the article is The Therapeutic Pyramid, Common Factors, Synthesis of Techniques, Alliance and Way of Being. Mm-hmm. And you create a pyramid, which at the bottom is way of being, right?
Yes.
And then kind of the therapeutic alliance. And then at the tip is the synthesis of techniques or what have you. Can you talk about, because this, and I actually found this article, I was telling you before we started talking, yeah. I found this article when I was teaching a practicum class, and I really like the idea of way of being and teaching way of being, because nobody's talking about it. I mean, right. At least in my experience. And nobody's learning how to just sit with a client in master's programs. It's so model specific and technique specific, and and just being able to sit with somebody is, you know. So it was really interesting to me, and it kind of guided this way I taught this practicum class. But can you tell me a little bit about how you conceptualize it, how you teach way of being, that kind of thing?
Yeah. I want to tell it through a story if I can.
Sure.
I was...
You're talking to a narrative therapist, of course.
Sure. Yeah, of course. Right. Yeah. What are you going to say? Yeah. No. No stories here.
Yeah, no stories. Yeah,
right. So I was back east in my doc program in Virginia. And my job at the time, I worked as an on-call crisis clinician. I would go out and do like the 5150s, we call them here in California, with people who had attempted suicide. And I was usually either in the sheriff's office or the ER. And it was overnight, and I was a full-time doc student as well, so busy. And I got a call in the middle of the night one winter to go out and assess a fellow who was at the sheriff's office. And it was at a sheriff's office that was about 100 miles away. It was a long ways away. And I'd been reading The Pragmatics of Human Communication, the MRI book.
Yep, another book.
Yeah, excuse me. And come across this concept that people can tell what you think about them no matter what. You communicate it non-verbally, but no matter what, people can tell how you regard them. You can't avoid that. And so I'd been thinking about that lately. It resonated. And so I'm driving down to assess this fellow, and I did not want to be there. It was cold. It was rainy. It was like 2 a.m. I had a final the next morning. I was exhausted. But I'm thinking of this, and I'm thinking it's not this fellow's fault that I don't want to be here. He has bigger things going on, and I owe it to him to show up, you know, and to give him my presence, my like emotional presence. I mean,
right.
And so I get there, we start talking, and he's curled up on a chair. And he's rocking back and forth. He's saying, everything's good, everything's good, everything's good, over and over. And I'm like, I'm going to really try to get to know this guy. And so I start asking him questions about him and just really trying to empathize, get into his world. What's it like to be him right now? And after a while, he stopped. He's still rocking back and forth, but he's looking at me very intently. Like he's staring like the front of my backbone type of thing,
yes,
right through me. After a while, he stops and he unfolds himself, and he's sitting in front of me, and he's answering my questions, and we're having a regular conversation back and forth. Whereas before he wasn't even answering me. We do this for a while. And I'm thinking, man, this is really interesting. This is great. And I look at the clock on the wall behind him. It's just a quick flash of in my mind, and it's 6 o'clock in the morning, and I have about 2 or 3 more hours worth of assessment left to do, 100-mile drive, and I have a final that I'm taking at like 9 or 10.
Wow.
So I am in trouble, and I see the clock and I think in my mind, oh boy, I need to hurry up. And as soon as I thought that, this fellow shrinks up again, curls up, starts rocking back and forth, saying everything's good, everything's good. And I didn't get another peep out of him.
Mm.
And I've reflected on that so much over the years. And I think we know what the state of our heart, the state of our kind of regard for other people is constantly on display. And never more so, I think, is it more important than in the therapy room. And the depth of the healing that a person goes through, the depth of themselves that they give to us is hugely contingent on the depth of regard that we're going to give that.
Wow.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
And you make me think of who I did want to talk about, Carl Rogers.
Yeah.
And, I've been doing a revisiting to Carl Rogers' work. A mentor of mine, John Winslade, wrote a paper on him and mm-hmm. just kind of reintroduced me to him. And he's popping up a lot lately.
Yeah.
And the more I mean, he was one of the first to say that, you know, as soon as you diagnose somebody, you've affected the relationship and just like really ahead of his time in a lot of ways. And so can you say something about him, how he influences you or Common Factor? I know he's part of the Common Factors tradition, right?
He is. Yeah. He is. You know, when I was first learning therapy, his stuff just seemed too soft to like too. What do you do with that? Okay, yeah, regard people well. Okay, but honestly, the longer I do this, and to be fair, I think the more comfortable I get with different theories and with being in the room.
Sure.
The longer I do this, the more I see. Man, he was really onto something. So much of this is just we're all suffering and we want someone to connect with us and to be with us while we're suffering and give us that and we'll be okay. Like we'll make it. Mm-hmm. You can do this trick or that technique or whatever, and that's fine. But if it's outside of the context of that really deep, sincere regard for someone, it won't matter as much. And that's what our pyramid article talks about, is that deep at the top of the pyramid, you have the techniques. The success of the techniques rests on the next level of the pyramid, which is the alliance. And this success of the alliance rests on the bottom level, which is your regard for the person.
Yeah. And the techniques is just the small point of the pyramid, really.
Yeah.
So how do you teach that?
Yeah, good question. Yeah. There are a couple of books that I really love and want to put in a plug for,
sure.
Even though I don't have nothing to do with them other than I like them. One of them is called Leadership and Self-Deception, and then the other one is called The Anatomy of Peace, both by a really small consulting firm called the Arbinger Institute. they're fascinating, and they flesh some of these ideas out more. And so I have my students read those books, and then I have them, that the books talk about treating people as a person versus treating people as an object.
Okay.
And goes into a lot of detail with that. Then I have them go spend a week trying to treat everyone they see as a person rather than an object. Mm-hmm. And talk about that. Then we process that and they write a paper on it.
And you said the response to that's been really positive. Like,
almost, yeah.
Like that's the best experience of their graduate program. Or
a lot of students come back and say, yeah, that this is where it's at. I wish we could do more of this.
Right.
Of course, there's responsibility on me to, as the professor, be in that same frame of mind as much as possible. You know, isomorphism is huge with this. You can't teach a principle like that if you aren't embodying.
Yeah, I think that's so important. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Why don't we finish up with implications for clinicians? And you have a list, and I'll go through them. Maybe we can go through them. But it starts with practice professional modesty. Choose a model you believe in. Who would have thought you were saying choose a model that you believe in? Practice your model flexibility and get as much feedback as you can. Can you talk about that, all of those?
Sure. Your passion about what you're doing matters. That in and of itself is a common factor. And so it's important that you do need a model, which we've already talked about, but you need to be passionate about that model.
Nice.
And the passion itself will be curative. They'll think, hey, this person, they seem to know what they're doing. They're excited. They have confidence in what they're about. And you get that confidence in part by trusting your approach, your theory. Yeah, so just really, really trying to immerse yourself in learning a theory, learning, and then moving on and learning another theory. And
is that the flexibility part?
Yeah, that's the flexibility part. Being open to your one theory may not be able to be everything to everyone.
Right. And that's the modesty part, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you may not be able to be everything to everyone. Like the theory, like every now and then I will refer someone out just because I tell them we've reached the end of what I can give you and you still need help, So professional modesty in terms of your own, weaknesses and limitations as well.
Great. And this idea of get as much feedback as you can you talk about that? Are you a ORS or SR person, Scott Miller?
I don't use them personally, but to be honest, it's more out of, I just haven't gotten around to it yet. The philosophy I'm very much on board with. If you look at a lot of therapists, I have made kind of a side hobby out of when I find a therapist that I think is really good, I ask them, I just try to find out what they're about. And one thing I've noticed, so many of them will record their own sessions and then watch it back.
I'm a believer. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. And they will get supervision. Like even if they've been practicing 20 years and are like at the peak of their game, they are very much involved in reaching out and saying, hey, what are your thoughts with this? Will you watch this? See what you think. They're still very much active learners.
Yeah. And I can't say enough about, I try and video a lot of my own work and instill that in our group, their supervision groups, et cetera.
Yeah.
People improve leaps and bounds when they're doing that, I think.
Yeah, me too. It's invaluable. I worry when I start to feel like I've got this figured out.
Right. And I really like your question. You added a question in that feedback, this idea, what has been pivotal?
Right.
What kind of responses do you get to that? Or is that where they tell you something and you're like, well, I never said that.
Right. With clients, you mean?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I do like to ask that, and I get widely differing answers. Usually, you know, one person will say one thing and their partner will say something completely different. And both of those things are different from what I thought was pivotal. So I do like to ask that. It also sort of presupposes that there are pivotal things, and it kind of wires people to start looking for them.
Right. Okay. So I know you got some grading to do, Dr. Davis. I really want to say thanks for taking the time out and educating me and talking and just joining us on the show. It's been a great conversation for me and hopefully for you as well.
And, absolutely.
Yeah.
Thanks,
so, yeah, I just want to say thank you. And the book is called Common Factors in Couple and Family Therapy. And as always, I will have a link, listeners, on the show notes so you can access that. And I'll actually link a couple of his articles as well so you can access some of the stuff we talked about. So have happy holidays, Dr. Davis. And I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it very much.
Yep.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's our show, and I once again want to thank you all for listening. Please, if you have any questions or would like to reach out to me, please do at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. And our website, as always, is at theradicaltherapist.com. Once again, I want to thank you for your support, for listening, for telling friends about the show. We really appreciate that, or even sending the show around, sending the link around to people. We really appreciate that, too. And I hope 2015 was a great year for you all, and I'm really excited about 2016, and I hope you'll continue to tune in to us throughout the next year. So happy holidays, everybody. Happy New Year. My name is Chris Hoff. This has been The Radical Therapist.